Okay, guys, we're going to go ahead and get started because I really want to honor you for having come on time. I really appreciate it, and I'm really like the idea of starting on time and ending on time. But I just want to thank you. Hi, David. I just want to thank you all for coming. It really means a lot, and I especially want to thank Nathan and Victor for coming right at the beginning and helping with chairs. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Let's go ahead and start with a serenity prayer, and then I'll tell you how our three-hour afternoon is going to lay out, okay? Taking a moment of silence for the compulsive eater, the bulimic, the anorexic, alcoholic, gambler, anybody, right? All are welcome. Anybody in pain, in this room or outside of the room. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. Did you have a hand up? Oh, you need me to talk louder? I don't know what this means. Oh, okay. I'll talk louder. And I'll tell you, at some point I'll probably stand a little bit. It's just they want this recorded. I guess we're going to try and get this up on the website, and I'm not quite sure how that will work in terms of walking and recording.
Why don't you just move the table?
Okay. All right. You want to help me? So that it doesn't drag? Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Thanks for the suggestion. Great suggestion. All right. And, thank you. Thank you for letting me know right away. And how it's going to go is I'm going to take about a half an hour. I'm going to tell you about my story. I was a chronic slipper. And then I'm going to tell you what I do in terms of working with chronic slippers, some things that I found to be very, very effective. And then we're going to go through the steps as they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're going to talk about that quite a bit. So there will be a break about halfway through and a 10-minute break. And we'll have a break and there will be a 10-minute break and then we'll start on time. So just, I want you to know I really value your time. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon and I so appreciate that you came. So I want you to know we'll really be in integrity with time and things. And then we will also end on time. And at the end, we'll have about a half an hour, 40 minutes for Q&A. All right? So again, thanks for coming. So my name is Sheila, and I'm a compulsive overeater. And I'm really very, very grateful to be here. And I came in Overeaters Anonymous in 1988. And what happened for me is I'm 48 years old. So I came in and I started really kind of drinking and drugging I started drinking a little bit in high school, but I was never a good drinker. And it kind of got out of control when I was in college. So when I was finishing up my four-year degree, which took 7 years to do, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, got sober right away. So I've been sober 24 years, and I remember turning to a woman next to me, and I said, do you think you can have a problem with sugar like you have a problem with alcohol? And she said, absolutely. Here's where you need to go. And so she pointed me toward Overeaters Anonymous. So I came in my first Overeaters Anonymous meeting in February of 1988. And I was going to be graduating from college a month later. And I heard, I will never forget this woman, I will never forget this meeting. I think there were about four of us in this meeting in the Midwest. I got sober and abstinent, well, aspired to abstinence in the Midwest. And if I had listened to this direction that this woman gave me at that first meeting, this would be a much different story. I wouldn't even be here because I wouldn't have been fooling around with the chronic slipping. And her direction was so simple and so wonderful, which is probably why I couldn't follow it. But she said, after the meeting, I stayed afterwards, she was the secretary of the meeting, and I said, well, what is this abstinence thing? What is this? How does this work? And again, I had about 3 months of sobriety at the time, so I kind of knew the drill in terms of 12-step programs. And she said, well, what is your problem food? And I said, well, I've got a horrible, horrible problem with sugar. I've got a horrible problem with sugar. And she said, well, and it was an 11 a.m. meeting, so now it's 12 noon, right? Meeting's over. She said, well, what if you had set it up that you weren't going to have sugar and you were going to eat 3 meals a day? Do you think you could do that? And I said, well, what do you do with the meals? And can we just have somebody raise your hand if you've got an open seat next to you because we just had somebody come in? So we've got a few open seats here. Okay. She said, what if you just had no sugar in three meals? And I said, what do you do for a meal? She said, well, you know, just have a meal. How about you just have what fits on a plate? And try that and call me tomorrow. So I took her number, and I went to a restaurant. So it's 12 noon, right? And I knew I had a weight problem. I weighed almost 200 pounds. And so I was going to an OA meeting, so I figured the deal was if you want to lose weight, you don't eat. So I hadn't eaten before I went to the meeting, right? So we're halfway through a day. I've been up for 6 or 7 hours, and I haven't eaten, right? Recipe for failure. And I went to a restaurant. I'll never forget where it was. I mean, I will never forget this. And I went in this restaurant, and I ordered a meal, and I had never had that meal in my life. And it was like eggs and toast and bacon and orange juice. Okay, that's the meal. But I'd never had that meal when I wasn't binging. Because it was always part of something larger, or it was, let's skip the toast and the eggs and let's just do, you know, a meat bonanza. You know, it was always some kind of gamey thing. And it was never a glass of orange juice. It was a quart. I mean, I'd never had that food, that meal in front of me where there wasn't some kind of game going on. And I ate the meal, drank the orange juice, went out to my car, sat in my car, and I thought, wow, so this is how it goes in this OA thing? And I thought, no, it's got to be more complicated than that. And for the next dozen years, I proceeded to complicate it because I could not take that very, very, very simple direction. So that was how I got introduced to All Readers Anonymous. Okay, here's why I needed to be in OA. So I always say, right, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I go to OA. And occasionally I step into other 12-step food meetings, right, where it's a little bit more structured. But OA is my home. OA is my mother food program. Always has been. And I always say, if you would have lined up a bottle of tequila, a joint, a carton of Marlboro Greens, and a hot fudge sundae, I would run to the hot fudge sundae. I still would. Like, hands down. And I, you know, my AA sponsor doesn't let me talk about this too much or chatter about it too much, but you don't ever have to worry about me drinking. Trust me, I'd rather have a hot fudge sundae than a bottle of wine. I really would. It's just no question. And but she says, don't be so sure. So at any rate, so my eating started. I was 4 years old, and we had a family friend who owned a grocery store. I was the youngest of five children. We were kind of lower middle class in the Midwest. My dad had gone to school on the GI Bill. My mother and started his own business, and my mother, you know, was high school educated. And it's just a shame. Both of my parents came from horrendous alcoholic families. Both of them had fathers who were alcoholics. My mother's father was a violent alcoholic, so he was a beater-upper. He didn't even just beat the kids, he beat them up. And my mother was the oldest, and she and her brother, 2 years younger than her, got the worst. And she was really a wounded, wounded bird because of it. And then my father's alcoholic dad was the kind of alcoholic that passed out, fell asleep, right? But both of them were certainly, you know, alcoholics. So I grew up in an alcoholic home. And, again, youngest of five kids. My oldest brother's deceased. He died of diabetes. We'll talk about that later. My mother also died of diabetes because in addition to their diabetes, like me, they had a raging sugar addiction. Could not stop eating sugar. But I was 4 years old, and we had a family friend who owned a grocery store. And I used to go with my mom to the grocery store, and he would offer me candy bars, but I had to give him a kiss. I had to let him kiss me. And I just remember his lips were really wet. It was really inappropriate. I remember this. And then later on, either he or a friend of his, somebody molested me. It was either my older brother or one of those two men. But we'll get to that part of the story as well. But that was the first inappropriate contact I can remember with a man. And I can remember thinking one day, and it was Milky Ways were my, you know, candy bar of choice, right? Or you know, actually my drug of no choice. I mean, let's be honest, right? Sugar's not my drug of choice. It's my drug of no choice. When I'm in it, it's, you know, eating sugar is like, you know, having sex with a gorilla. You're done when the gorilla says you're done, right? I'm not done. I'm just not, you know. That's just how it goes, right? I don't say, okay, well, I've had enough sugar. It just doesn't go that way. The gorilla just says, no, baby, we are not done. But this guy would have me give him kisses. And I can remember the day I just thought, you know, I am not going to kiss him anymore for these candy bars. I'm just going to start stealing them. And I did. So stealing was a huge, huge part of my story. It was a huge part of my story. But that was when I started stealing. And again, I was always, you know, I'd blow through my Halloween candy, then I'd start into my siblings, and then, you know, the best friends who were thin, right, who still had Halloween candy at Easter. It's like, are you kidding me? Right? So I had to blow through their stuff. I mean, I was always, and then shoplifting later on became a part of my story, and it was just amazing what I would do for sugar. And by the time I got, I was a cheerleader in junior high, and a junior high in the Midwest was 7th through 9th grade. So I was a cheerleader in the 7th through 9th grade. I was too fat by the time I got to high school. Once I went through puberty, because I was, you know, had molestation in my past, you go through a very difficult time when you're going through puberty. And, you know, something horrible is going to happen. I'll be possessed by the devil. I mean, it's really big, deep stuff, right? That's how you know. And when I started as a cheerleader, I was the one that went on top. And by the time I was a cheerleader in the ninth grade, I was a base, right? That's the one where you're, like, leaning over, right? And the little girls are climbing on you, right? You're a base. And then by the time I got to high school, I had a very competitive cheerleading squad, and they just didn't have fat cheerleaders on their squad. And I started college, and it wasn't the freshman 15 that I gained. It was like the freshman 40, I guess. I worked at a McDonald's, and that's kind of an important part of the story because we're going to get back to that when I talk about the amends when I got to my eighth and ninth step. But I stole a lot of food at McDonald's. I stole a lot of food, ate a lot of food, gave away a lot of food, took a lot of the game tickets. They used to have this Monopoly game, and it's just by the grace of God that I never won $1 million in that stupid McDonald's Monopoly game because, right, what do you do when you get to a ninth step there, right? I guess you pay back $1 million. And so I'm just so lucky that I never won. But so I did a lot of stealing, and then came home from my freshman year, and I was, you know, that much heavier. And I guess I hit my 200-pound mark about my second or third year in college. And then discovered drugs, and you know, I was really a pothead, and I wasn't as much of a drinker because I couldn't really hold my alcohol. And quite frankly, if I'm going to drink, I'd rather have Kahlua, right, over Haagen-Dazs than, you know, a tequila shot or something. I mean, again, I just couldn't hold my liquor. And the deal is, I like sweet stuff, and I like it on my palate. That's what I like. And but it got to be a real problem in terms of my drug addiction. I'd had a fiancé who died of a cocaine overdose. I'd totaled a car on my birthday. I mean, I had enough bad things happening with the drugs and alcohol that despite, you know, funny things were going on with my food, the drugs and alcohol should have been what really got my attention, but it really wasn't for a long time. But then as I was finishing school, again in that seventh year, my parents had run out of patience, and my dad, again, we were lower middle class, and my dad just wasn't going to pay for, you know, he begrudgingly paid for a few C's when I got him in college. But once I got my first D, my dad said, that's it, I'm not paying for D's, right? So he cut me off. And so I had to get a student loan for that last, I think it was like my last 15, 18 credits, right? And I wasn't living at my parents' home, I didn't have any money. I mean, my life was a mess, right? And I was living with, I found a woman who had three young daughters. She was a single mother, and she needed basically a nanny. So she needed somebody in her house to be taking care of her daughters, driving her kids around while she was working. And I knew that so this was fall of 1987, and I knew that something bad was going to happen, and I was going to be driving this woman's kids around. I just knew it. I knew something bad was going to be happening, and I didn't want that one on my life resume. You know, I figured if I was drunk driving or drug driving or something, and I killed myself, well, problem solved. If I killed you and you'd made it to adulthood, well, you had made it to adulthood. I figured if I killed us both, well, then I don't have to worry about anything. But I didn't want to kill anybody's kids. So that's what got me into eventually to the AA program. And then 3 months there, clear there, I got very, very clear about the fact that sugar was my big deal. Sugar was my big deal. And it just always was. So I came in, and couldn't take that direction from that first sponsor, and I played the game by the rules, right? I was really lucky. I got sober in the Midwest, and they don't fool around there. You come into an AA meeting in the Midwest, and they don't say the newcomer's the most important person in the room, right? They say, actually, I don't know if they're this harsh about it. This is how I remember it. But, you know, they say, actually, you have very little that we want to hear. Why don't you sit in the back and be quiet? And and I had just recently quit smoking cigarettes because I quit smoking and drinking at the same time. That gives you an idea of how dependent I was on food. I can remember being 3 months sober and sitting, excuse me, just saying, do you guys need chairs? Do we have, raise your hand if there's an open seat next to you. So we've got one or two, you know, up here, and then we've got chairs back here. Monica's going to help you find chairs, and we can bring chairs out. Thank you for coming. Glad you're here. But where was I? Anybody remember? Oh, that's so cute. I cannot. Here's what I hear. Where did I? Very good. Thank you. So I was 3 months sober. Thank you very much. So I was 3 months sober, and I remember sitting in the back of AA meetings and, you know, looking at all around the people who were kind of the same amount of sober time that I had, and that, you know, they were all antsy and crawling up the walls, and I was just thinking, what's the big deal, right? Meanwhile, I got the plate of donuts right in front of me, right? It was just no big deal. Because I quit smoking pot and quit drinking. Because I just ate more. Because that was what I wanted to do anyway. That was always what I wanted to do. So it felt like it was no big deal for me. Now the truth is, it's a huge deal. If you're an alcoholic and a drug addict and you have kind of the life resume that I have with that, it's a big deal when you're not doing it anymore. But I just leaned in and did more of what I wanted to do, which was eat and eat sugar. And again, because I was sponsored well right from the beginning, and I was directed when I came into Overeaters Anonymous to work the steps no matter what. Regardless of what I was eating, I was directed to work the steps. Now, apparently there's some big controversy behind this. I don't know how you argue with somebody's experience. I think you're a fool to get in a pit and argue with an alcoholic anyway. You're just like arguing with a toddler. You're going to lose, right, and get humiliated. But I don't know how you argue with somebody's experience. And there's a whole group of people that say, well, you can't work the steps until people get abstinent. That's absolute nonsense from my experience. It just didn't work from my experience. So because I was directed to work the steps, regardless of what I was eating, that is what saved me. That's why I started at 200 pounds in 1988. I have not weighed 200 pounds since beginning of 1989. I haven't weighed that much. I've never gone back up. Now, I'm a chronic slipper, and I've lost and gained over 1,650 pounds, and we'll talk about that, despite the fact I'm not a 100-pounder and never went back up to 200. It's not like I kept racing up and down. But I would lose and gain 15 pounds three times a year. And I did this for a dozen years. Well, that's 90 pounds a year. And I had a registered dietitian who had me track it. So if you give me a month and a year, I can tell you within 5 pounds what I weighed. And what my husband will say is, I don't know what's crazier, that you can do that or that you know that. Like, both are true, right? But that's just what it is. But that was my pattern. But I was directed to work the steps no matter what. And keep that in mind, right? Write that down and put that on a post-it on the wall. Because that saved my life. I'm thoroughly convinced that's why I never went back up to 200 pounds. Now, I would bounce between like 160 and 175. That was kind of my thing. But I never went back up to my top weight. And a year and a half, 2 years after I came into OA, my father had three overweight daughters and he didn't like it. Now, ironically, or not so ironically, my father had been very overweight as a child. So his later justification when I went into an eating disorder unit and brought him out there, right, and put him in the middle of a circle with 50 angry women, right, all like, you're the one who did this. We've been listening to her bitch about you for the last month in treatment, right? You're the monster, right? When, you know, my father said it out loud that the reason he had been so hurtful to us about our weight, to all of my sisters and myself, is because he knew how painful it was to be overweight, right? That's the insanity of an alcoholic family, right? You don't think, oh, that was painful, let me not do that. You think, oh, that was painful, let me help you out of the pain by being hurtful to you. But that was his rationale, and that was his thinking behind it. But it didn't work. It didn't work. But I could not stop eating the sugar. So I was sponsored. I was going to meetings. I, you know, was slowly coming down from my top weight. And I remember, as I know what I was going to say, 2 years into this, I remember being at some family event, and I walked out, and my dad said, you know, are you putting on weight again? And I turned around again. This was with 2 years of OA recovery, working the steps despite the fact I was not out of the food. I certainly wasn't out of the sugar. Might have been moderately out of the food, but I wasn't out of the sugar. And I turned around to my dad, and I was, what, 25 years old? And I said, no more. You do not talk to me about my weight. No more. It's over. And my dad never spoke to me about my weight again, ever. Right? That's how I know that working the steps, regardless of whether you are in the food, works. Because that's how it worked from my experience. That's why I sponsor people that way. That we are going to work the steps regardless of what's going on with the food. Okay? Put that on a post-it note. Okay? So that's what we've got going on. So again, but I could not figure out why I could not stop eating sugar. So I was staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I continued to be in the sugar. Could not stop. And I finally reconciled myself. I was in a relationship, and he was a boyfriend, and then he was a fiancé. I was engaged for 10 years, and, you know, we finally got married a year and a half ago. And it was a ring on the finger engagement, right? I mean, fear is something that has been a big part of my life for a long time. I move slowly, apparently. But my husband, you know, my lovely, lovely husband, Neil, I got very, very clear about the fact he loved me no matter what I weighed. You know, he just did. And what can I say? I mean, I got my mother's big ass and big thighs and little thin fingers. Thanks, Mom. But he loves me no matter what I weighed. So I kind of reconciled myself, right? It was the end of 2003. I'd had a major health issue. I'd gotten diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1994. And so I went to doctors, and they had certain things they wanted you to do in terms of diet. And that's the worst possible thing you can say to somebody who's got an eating disorder, who now has a chronic illness diagnosis, is don't eat A, B, and C. Because I'm going to go out and eat A, B, and C, D, E, F, G, right? I'm just going to do it because that's the, you know, that's the wackiness, right? And so I had lots of reasons. So like my diabetic brother and my diabetic mother, and we'll come back to the diabetic brother, I could not stop despite the fact I had really important health reasons. And I had watched my brother years before. My brother got diagnosed with diabetes. He was 15 years old, and he died when he was 36. And he could not stop eating sugar. In addition to his diabetes, like me, he had a sugar addiction. He just could not stop eating sugar. And it's not a pretty death when you die of diabetes. It's just not. And my brother died. Both his legs were gone. He had been on dialysis for the last 3 years of his life, and he'd gone blind. And he was in an old people's home for those last 3 years, right? He was a 33-year-old guy who went into an old people's home. And he could not stop eating sugar. I mean, he had friends slipping it in, bringing it into him in the home. He could not stop eating sugar. And literally, I mean, when you lose your legs as a diabetic, it's not like they just take off your legs. You know, first they start with the baby toe, then the next two, then below the ankle, then above the ankle, then below the knee, then they start on the other leg. I mean, you're literally losing your body piece by piece. And he could not stop eating sugar. He couldn't stop. That's the kind of sugar eating I come from. And you know what? 8 years later. How many? 8 years later, the same thing happened to my mom. Just happened quicker. And she got the diabetes that she didn't have juvenile onset, right? She had the one where you just have to start with pills, and if you get your business together and you stop eating sugar, start there, and then maybe you lose some weight, because my mom was like a 250-pound woman at the time. You know, if you do that, there's a good chance you can get off. She couldn't stop eating sugar. And she was dead within... She was in a coma the last 2 months of it. She got diagnosed and was in a coma a year and a half later and was gone 2 months into the coma. She just couldn't stop eating sugar. And she, too, ended up losing her legs. And It's not a pretty death. And I remember pitching this at an OA meeting once. This is part of why I ended up leaving OA and kind of going to a more structured program, because somebody, you know, the secretary of the meeting came up and she said, you know, I don't think you should share that at meetings. You're going to scare people. And I said, you know what? I actually want to scare people. I really want to scare people. I really do. Because this is really scary business. It really is. I know 3 people from Overeaters Anonymous from my 25 years here who've killed themselves. One woman put a gun in her mouth because she couldn't stop eating Snickers bars. right? I know an anorexic that starved to death. Not on my watch. She was my sponsee. And when I directed her to start eating, not because that's my good idea, but because I turned to other anorexics who were recovered in program and said, well, she's got to eat. She's got to eat. And when she wouldn't take the direction, then she fired me as a sponsor. 6 months later, I showed up at an event and I heard her name and I said, oh, where is she? And they said, oh, haven't you heard? She died. I said, how'd she die? And they said, she starved to death. So this is really serious business here. So and I had lots of juice that would have should have indicated to me that it was time to stop. And I couldn't stop. That's why I love chronic slippers. And I feel no frustration behind chronic slippers. We'll talk about that when we get to working with chronic slippers. I feel no frustration at all. Whereas I've got a sponsor. My sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous won't sponsor chronic slippers. And that's all I'll sponsor. That's all I'll sponsor in this program and in the mother program. I always say I want the sponsee that nobody else wants. I really do. Because we're going to figure out very, very quickly whether or not you're done. That's all we have to do. That's all it's about, is figuring out whether or not you're done. So it was taking me a long time to get done. And I didn't know what that was about. So I eventually got to the point of real surrender. So it's like the end of 2003. And surrender is a really powerful thing, right? When you are out of good ideas, and you can lay, right, akimbo on the floor, arms and legs splayed, and you have no more good ideas, that's a really powerful place to be. And I had gotten very, very surrendered, and I thought, well, maybe I don't have a bottom with sugar. Maybe the deal is that sometimes I'm going to be a 14, 12, 14, and other times maybe I'm going to be a 10. Maybe I'll be able to squeeze into the 8s for, you know, a weekend, right? Maybe. And that's just how it's going to go. And I got very surrendered. And you know what? I got struck abstinent from sugar. And I had different periods of abstinence from sugar over those, you know, 12 years, right? But I got struck abstinent from sugar over the holidays. Go figure. So it was like the beginning of probably end of Thanksgiving, probably after, I'm guessing, after Thanksgiving, and then into the holiday season through New Year's. So now it's January 12th. It's 13th. It's Tuesday the 13th. In 2004, and I've been off sugar for about 7 weeks, and I'm out with my husband at dinner, and we've gone to this really nice fancy restaurant, and then it's 11 o'clock at night, right, because we're doing the late dinner thing, because I, you know, like to eat late, and I decide, who knows what, maybe the waiter looked at me cross-eyed, who knows what happened, but I decided that I was going to have sugar, and we were going to share a dessert. So I was going to pretend I was one of those cute little Hollywood types, right, who can sit with a dessert in the middle of the table and share the dessert with her boyfriend, husband, whatever, right, partner, whatever it is. So they bring the dessert, right, some elaborate thing, like, I really don't need it that elaborate, really, but okay. And, you know, the 2-4, and we're sharing, right, we're eating the dessert. Except my husband is eating twice as many bites as I am, and I know because I'm counting, right? So I'm counting the bites. So now we're in trouble, right? Because I've been off sugar for 7 weeks, right? I got a head full of program, so I know how this works, right? And it's now 11 o'clock at night. I've gone through the holiday season, so all those feelings that, you know, were, I was kind of keeping them down because I was kind of doing the deal, because it wasn't a white knuckle thing. For me to be off sugar, I have to really be doing the deal. So I was in meetings, playing the game, maybe making outreach calls, doubtful. That came much later to start doing outreach calls. But I was doing the deal to some extent for 7 weeks, and now all of a sudden I'm back in the sugar, and all bets are off. And it's everything that Silkworth talks about in The Doctor's Opinion. So now I've unleashed that allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. The obsession of the mind never goes away. That's why we do 12-step work for the rest of our life, right? Because the obsession of the mind is never going to go away. But that allergy of the body, it's not an urban myth. I saw an allergist last summer, a very good one in this town, and he literally said it is 21 days. It takes about 21 days to physiologically break an allergy. So I was well off the allergy, the physical component of it, but now I've unleashed all of them, right? The obsession of the mind, now it's really racing because it's that much worse when I'm in the food and the sugar in particular, that is my deal. I'm more of a sugar eater than a quantity eater, right? So now we're really in trouble, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and boy do I feel sorry for the fiance, the guy sitting across from me, because now, right, now, it game on, So I'm thinking, okay, so we get the check, and we're, because now it's like, get the check, please, right? It's like, I got to get out of here. So I need to get more sugar, and I need to get it very, very quickly. So I'm already thinking of the lies as we're walking to the car, right? Because, you know, so what are the lies that I'm going to tell, right? Because I'm a chronic slipper, and chronic slippers are chronic victims, and we're chronic liars. That's just the truth, and we'll talk about that when we get to slippers. But we're liars, and we're slippers. And, so I'm already thinking the lie that I'm going to tell my husband because I need more sugar. And the stuff, you know, the few things we have at the house that he eats, I don't want what he eats, right? And so I'm thinking, well, I know. I'll tell him that I need to get tampons. So I have to stop at the store. That was a big one when I was in high school. I would lie to the, you know, the high school boys who were driving me home, right, from a party or whatever. They all drank. I was like, where's the chocolate? And I'm getting driven home by these high school boys, and I would need chocolate because it's the end of a party, and I got no attention, and nobody loved me and adored me. Meanwhile, I was, you know, sitting in a corner not paying attention to anybody. But I needed sugar, and I would lie to these high school boys, and I'd say, you know, can we stop at the 7-Eleven because I need to get tampons. And, you know, you say tampon to a high school boy, and they're like, well, you know, sure, yeah, right, okay, right, and they're just, like, driving, like, tunnel vision, going straight ahead. And I would go in, and I would get these Brock's chocolates in a box, right, and I would, you know, have them put them in the brown paper bag, right, just like an alcoholic with their booze. I've got my chocolate in a bag, right, praying that the stars aren't going to, like, shake in the bag, right, when I the car and stuff. But so lying, you know, this was familiar territory for me. I'll tell my husband that I need to get tampons, right, because I need to get sugar. But wait a minute. My husband is going to want to, he's a gentleman, so we're going to stop the store, and he's going to want to go in the store and get the tampons for me, because, you know, I got an involved husband who can buy tampons. So that's not going to work. So I thought, I know, I'll wait until we get home. But then I have to have another lie to explain why I want to be the one to go out and get the tampons at 11:30 at night now, and why he needs to go in and he can deal with the dogs. Okay, but wait a minute. He might remember I actually just finished my period about a week ago. So I know ovarian cysts. Like, I'm literally thinking, I'll tell him I've got ovarian cysts and it's like chronic bleeding or something. I don't know, honey. Don't ask questions. Just go in the house, deal with the dogs, and I'll go get the shirt. Like, literally. And I mean, it's like we were ready to go. That was going to be the lie. My hand touched the handle. So again, this is the 13th. It's Tuesday the 13th, 2004. My hand touched the handle of our car, and I thought, wow, I'm so glad I don't live in a high-rise. And I thought, wow, where did that thought come from? And I got it. In that moment, I finally got powerlessness over sugar. Because I got it. I could no longer guarantee if I kept eating sugar, right? If I kept eating sugar, I couldn't guarantee that I wasn't going to one day take myself out, that I wasn't going to kill myself. I got it in that moment. Oh, and by the way, this was with 4 years of OA abstinence, because I finally encountered an OA sponsor who said to me, no more starting over. You're going to work the steps with me. You're going to call me, and we'll talk about this when I get to sponsorship. You're going to call me 5 days a week at a set time, and we are going to work the steps. And you're going to be honest with me about your food, or I invite you to be honest with me, but no more starting over. So I guess I had 3.5 years of abstinence at that point. And that woman changed my life again. So that was a deeper working with the steps, but it was somebody literally lovingly taking me by the scruff of the neck and saying, no more starting over. Your abstinence starts now. So even though, so now I, you know, so on top of this, right, I was abstinent in OA, and I, you know, I felt fine about it. I knew I was in integrity. I was taking direction from a sponsor. I knew that all was well. But I just could not stop eating the sugar. But my hand touched the handle of that car, and I got it in that moment. I finally got powerlessness. I could no longer guarantee if I kept in the sugar that I wasn't one day going to kill myself. And that one I really didn't want on my resume. I really, really didn't want that one on my resume. I just didn't. I didn't want to kill myself. So I don't know what I did. I know there was no lie. There were no ovarian cysts that night. There was nothing like that that happened. I know I went home, but I got up the next day, and what did I do? I had sugar again. Like, I literally had that awareness that if I did this, I might kill myself, and I got up the next day and had sugar again. But then the following day, January 15th, 2004, the sugar obsession was released, and I haven't had it since. And it was just gone. It was just gone. But that was my journey in terms of letting go of sugar. So just remember the very important component of the story. I was working the steps from the very, very beginning, and then I took sponsor direction when somebody said to me, no more starting over with your abstinence. You work the steps, you be committed with me in our relationship, you play the game by the rules in terms of going to meetings, helping others, right, all the stuff we do here, the tools, all those things, but no more starting over. And 3.5 years into it, the obsession was removed from me. So that was my story. That was my experience. And then slowly the weight started coming off. And then about 2 years into that abstinence, I had a sponsor who said to me, a different sponsor who said, I think we need to pay attention to this agave nonsense or whatever it is you're eating. You know, I think not. Let's just put it down. And I, you know, wailed and, right, gnashed my teeth. But I put that down, and then, you know, the final 25 pounds, whatever, came up. I don't know. I weigh about 135, 140, somewhere around there. And that was a real miracle when I got relieved of that sugar obsession, and the sugar was gone, because I had been eating sugar. You know, I have a filling or a crown in just about every molar in my mouth. I really do. And I just ate unfathomable amounts of sugar. I really did. It's amazing how much sugar I ate. I could eat a pound of See's chocolates, and then I'd be like, okay, and now where are we going? Now what? Now what are we doing? Right? It's really kind of strange how much sugar I can eat. I have had a doctor who said you have a very fast metabolism, because it's amazing how much sugar I ate. I'm surprised I didn't weigh more than 200 pounds. But so then I was doing the deal and program, and then I got really clear that I needed to be on a weighed and measured food plan. So I weigh and measure my food. And again, so back here in the back, I still have the MS diagnosis. And I have, you know, the doctor who's kind of getting my attention, and I'm very fortunate I don't have any appreciable problems with it, won't have any appreciable problems. I've actually had one doctor who suggests that I don't have it anymore. You know, who knows? Doesn't matter. But I knew that I needed to really start paying attention to what I was eating. So it wasn't even about what I weighed. And I knew that for me to get where I wanted to get, because I was going to be seeing different healthcare professionals, and I couldn't have the lack of clarity around what I'm eating and quantities and things like that, I knew I needed to have some concrete information that I could give healthcare professionals if I really wanted recovery. So I knew that I needed to weigh and measure. And so I went to a registered dietitian, because I have a very wise MD who sent me to a registered dietitian. And this woman changed my life. And there were, you know, two wonderful RDs that I saw. One who helped me for over the years while I was kind of struggling and couldn't let go of the sugar, and she was a real game changer. And then this woman who really got me, who's, you know, science-based, and she just loves numbers and breaks it down. And I just follow a very clear food plan, and in terms of a weighed and measured food plan. So, and that's been really crucial for me. But what happened for me is I was in the more structured program, the more rigid program, and people were saying that people there wouldn't sponsor them if they didn't use their very rigid food plan, despite the fact a tenet of that program is that if you need to use a food plan from another healthcare professional, that's fine. Well, people were coming up to me because they couldn't get sponsored by people in that program, and that really pissed me off. It really pisses me off if we're, you know, not following the directions, if we have certain things that we do here and then we're not following the direction. So I just realized that I wanted to be of service to people who are chronically slipping. And I wanted to be somebody who would give somebody a safe place. And because I had that experience, because now I'm like 4 or 5 years abstinent, and I had that experience, and I realized I had something really valuable, and that I wanted to help people who, like me, felt they had not been invited to the party. Those were the people I really wanted to be of service to. And I started finding kind of some things that had been true about me in my own life and things that I found were true for chronic slippers. And I started sponsoring people in those ways, having certain requirements, having learned from this wonderful OA sponsor who started sponsoring me in 2000. She's the one who said, I'm declaring that you're abstinent, no more starting over. That woman changed my life. I'm not going to mention her name. She's still in program, but she's I just don't know if she would want her name out there. But that woman changed my life. And I took the things that she had done and some things from my experience and started sponsoring people who were chronic slippers, both in this program and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here are some of the things that I've found that have been very, very helpful. So this is in terms of sponsoring people who are chronic slippers. Because how many of people, I mean, raise your hand if you came in the room and you got abstinence right away, and I know you're one of them. If you came in the room and you got abstinent right away, Maury's got like 30 years. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and it's incredible, right? It's incredible that you guys did that. That's amazing, right? Yeah. But that was not my story. So, right, so the rest of us, right, we're people who, right, raise your hand if, like, you had it, lost it. Okay, look. So look around the room. So see, that's the pattern for most people. Most people don't come in here and get abstinent right away. So if you don't have that experience of how to be of service to chronic slippers, that's what this workshop was all about. So that's why it was about sponsoring people who are chronic slippers. Because there's a whole host of people. Now raise your hand if you're not abstinent today. Okay. So there are some people here who are not abstinent, right? And we have a responsibility. It's our responsibility to be of service to those people. That's my responsibility. Right? And it's not just bumper sticker stuff. It's not just, you know, oh, I put my hand in yours, or, you know, the hand of whatever that thing is, right? The thing that basically says, get out of yourself and help someone else. That's not just stuff we say here. It's really not. This is my responsibility. This is, and we'll talk about that as we go through the book. The book's really specific. So that is our responsibility. So here are things that I do with chronic slippers. Is I bring home the point, I always tell people, I'm not the sponsor for you if you don't want to hear the truth. If you don't want to hear both hear the truth and discover the truth about yourself. Because when you work the steps as they're outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are going to discover the truth about yourself. You just are. That's why it's so powerful. That's the reason I will only sponsor people from the Big Book of AA. Right? They started in the 60s is when discussion meetings really kicked in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before then, they were always speaker meetings or Big Book meetings. And in the 60s, our success rate went way down. Went down to like 50%. And then in 1980, I think it was 1980, they tracked it again, the success rate in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is, people who came in and 5 years later were still, it was either 5 years or, I think 5 years is the number, were still going to be sober 5 years later was 33%. Now it's about 5%. Right? Now, does that have to do with the fact that people in the 60s, that was when it really kicked in that people started sponsoring people from the 12 and 12, right? And stopped really sponsoring people from the Big Book. Is it that? Is it that we had such a rampant breaking of anonymity that happens so routinely now? So routinely? And we'll talk about that too, but anyway. Yeah, that happens routinely. And we know that things were falling off because you can get information in the book in 39. So the books came out, right, the various years, and it'll let you know when the new edition of the book came out, they knew how many Big Books were circulating, and then they knew how many people were sober. So in 54, when the second edition of the Big Book came out, there were 300,000 books that were circulating, and there were 150,000 people sober in meetings. In 75, when the book came out again, third edition, there were 1.15 million books that were circulating. And again, you get all this information from the forewords of the Big Book, right, the forewords and the preface. There were 1.15 million books circulating, and there were 1 million members sober. In 2000... there were 19.55, so let's say 20 million Big Books that were circulating, right, when that new edition, right, the fourth edition came out, there were only 2 million sober alcoholics. So how did those numbers fall off? What's that about, right? That'd be an interesting sociological treatise, right? There's a dissertation for somebody. How do you keep your anonymity, but, right? But that's really fascinating to me. How did that happen? How did that happen? I don't know. So different people have different theories, but at any rate, it's something worth paying attention to. But I tell sponsees, right? This is about knowing the truth, and I'm sure there are angry ex-sponsees of mine out there, maybe angry current sponsees, who knows, who would say that I'm harsh. And I always tell people, no, I'm not harsh. I'm clear. Right? I'm not harsh. I'm clear. Right? I don't shame people. But I'm going to tell you the truth. So I'm not going to say, oh, you lied about your food. You're bad. You're bad. I'm not going to do that. But I'm going to say, well, you lied about your food. How's that work? How's that working for you? Right? I'm going to tell you, I'm going to bring you to the truth. I'm going to bring truth to you. Right? And it's not like I go in meetings and I pick them out and I say, like, yeah, she needs my sponsorship. Let me get her number down. It's not like I go home and I call these people. People are already calling me. Right? So you're calling me. So we have this initial conversation where we're saying, this is about truth-telling. So I'm not the sponsor for you if you don't want this truth. And here's the other thing. I'm not the only one who can help you with your problem. Right? Anybody can help you. If you're drowning, anybody can help you. A blue boat, a red boat, a purple boat, a green boat, brown boat can save your life. But get out of the water. Get in a boat! Right? Get in a boat. And if you get in my boat, you've gotten in a red boat. Right? And if you're in my boat, well, you're in my boat. And it's not like I'm the captain of the ship. God is the captain, right? God is the sea, right? But I'm certainly got seniority over you, right? Because you got my boat, right? Right? I don't want what you have, right? Supposedly you have what I want. Supposedly, right? Supposedly you, right, you want what I, thank you. Supposedly you want what I have. And you know, I've had sponsees get mad at me. People get mad and they'll be like, I don't want what you have. I'm going to let you go as a sponsor. I don't want what you have. And I'm like, you know what? That's fine. On my bad days, I don't want what I have. It's all right. You're going to hurt my feelings. I got it. Right? But I know I don't want what you have. So you've gotten in my boat. And if you've gotten in my boat, we're going to do what I have found from my experience and from what I have garnered from this book. And that's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to work the program. And all we're going to do is figure out if you're done. That's all we're going to do. That's all it is. Anybody who's not abstinent, and those people who raise their hand, anybody who's not abstinent, they're just not done. You're not done. You're not done with the food. That's all it is. And maybe if somebody had said that, remember I said my pattern was to come in, you know, gain 15 pounds, gain, lose. I do that 3 times a year, 90 pounds a year, right? Did that for years. Maybe if somebody would have said to me when I got back into the sugar again, honey, you're just not done. Now, I had a mean sponsor or two in the beginning, but I just was putting too much recovery together in Alcoholics Anonymous. I stopped, you know, being mean to me was going to solve my problem. My dad would have solved my weight problem years ago, right? So I got real clear I didn't need anybody to be mean to me. But I certainly didn't have anybody saying to me, honey, you're just not done. You're just not done. Usually I cut and ran in defense of, you know, everybody who sponsored me over the years. Right. Usually I was the one who cut and ran. But if somebody would have just said to me, honey, you're just not done. That's all right, baby. You're just not done. Maybe I would have gone out and gained 5 pounds instead of 15. Right? Maybe I would have bought 2 candy bars instead of, you know, going to Costco. Maybe. Maybe. Maybe I would have done that. But I didn't know that. I thought there was something wrong with me or that I was bad. Well, I thought I was evil. Right? It's all tied in with old stuff, old religious stuff, Catholic stuff. But you can't blame it on the Catholic Church. Catholic Church is a, you know, it's a human institution. They're going to screw up, right? And but I just wasn't done. I wasn't done. So I say to people, I say, we're going to figure out if you're done. We're going to figure that out very quickly. And the way we're going to figure that out is by the work that you do. Period. That's all this is about. It's all about doing the work. Nobody gets left behind in this game. Nobody gets left behind in the life game. Nobody gets left behind ever. But I'll tell you what, in these rooms, for sure, nobody gets left behind. If you're not abstinent, or you're abstinent and you don't weigh what you want to weigh, it's about what you're doing or not doing. And all I'm saying is, let's just stop lying about it. So this is all the conversation, this is the beginning of the conversation I'm having with somebody on the phone. right? And it's always like a, 45-minute conversation, because it kind of becomes hard to reach me and stuff, especially if somebody's calling for sponsorship, because I want to see, because it's a big time investment. It's a big emotional investment. It's a big time investment. It doesn't take a long time. We go through the steps in the big book. It only takes about 2 or 3 months. But I just have a lot of people asking for help and stuff. So we got to figure out how committed you are to doing the work. So, if we get to the end of the conversation, it's a good sign, right? Because this is a lot of stuff people have to hear on the phone, because you have to hear that you're a chronic liar and you're a chronic victim, right? Nothing is being withheld from you. If you're not abstinent, it's not because we don't love you. It's not because God doesn't love you. It's not because of those things. It's because you're not doing the work. And you know what? It's really okay to not do the work. Just stop lying about it. Stop lying. See, that's what I want people to get. Stop lying. Just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. Just say, you know what? I'd rather eat than be conscious. I'd rather eat than have sex with my husband. I'd rather eat than just about anything, right? I would. Just be honest about it. Start there. Just start there. Just start telling the truth, right? That's a very powerful thing. People, chronic slippers in particular, are not used to somebody saying, it's okay if you want to be in the food. People aren't used to that, right? We get a lot of finger wagging here. Well-meaning finger wagging, in a way, right? Even more in some of the other programs. Well-meaning, but a lot of finger wagging. I don't wag my finger. It's not my business. Remember, I got a dead brother and a dead mother. I'm real clear. I can't get anybody absent. I can't save anybody's life. If I would, I'd be celebrating Mother's Day with my mommy, right? I can't save anybody's life. But I can help you figure out the lie. That I'm really good at helping people do. And if we get on a phone call, I can help you figure out the lie. Because somewhere, you're telling yourself a lie. If you're not abstinent and you want to be, or you say you want to be, but you're not, somewhere you're telling yourself a lie. And I'm just saying, let's just stop lying about it. Let's just figure it out. Let's just stop lying about it. I'm not doing questions right now. Save it. Write it down, Linda. We'll do it at the end. But let's just stop lying about it. Right? Let's figure this thing out. And so I give them a lot of stuff to do. I give chronic slippers, people that I sponsor, and chronic slippers is not some scary moniker. Bill Wilson was a chronic slipper, right? Dr. Bob is a chronic slipper. People are like, oh, I don't want that label. I'm like, okay, right? Okay. Call yourself Rainbow. Right? Whatever. It's just, whatever. But, I mean, it's just not a big deal to me. It's just, this was my pattern, right? I would go in and out, in and out, in and out. And, I know, a rainbow workshop. But I give them a lot of stuff to do. Because we have to figure out really quickly whether or not you're done. And the only way we're going to figure that out is based on the work you do or you don't do. And you know what? That ain't my good idea. I always have people start reading Working with Others, the chapter 7 in the big book. And I say, pay special attention to page 96. Because on page 96, it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, it says basically, we find it a waste of time to try and help a man who will not work with you. You're basically going to be depriving somebody else who's ready to do the deal if you help somebody who's not willing to work with you. So don't do it. It's basically what it says. So these are not my good ideas, right? The book's real clear about that. And I take that pretty literally. Now, I've had intelligent discussions, well, at least they were intelligent on my end. I've had intelligent discussions with people who I felt like, weren't intelligent because they read that differently. They say, well, no, it doesn't mean that at all. And I say, well, again, I'm not going to argue with an alcoholic. But especially a sober one, long time sober. Those are the worst ones to argue with because they know everything, right? But to me, it seems really clear about that. I mean, let's just look at it, right? Page 96. it. Paragraph right at the top. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. So I tell people, we're going to figure this out really quickly, but I need you to, so they read this chapter, I say, pay attention to that paragraph, so then, you know, maybe they call me back the next day. They're going to call me back. Usually they do. And I say, okay, so we're going to, you know, there are things that I'm going to have you do on a daily basis. And I need you to do these things. I need you to do them because they work from my experience, or they're things that the book tells us to do. And if you don't want to do them, it's really okay. I'm not the sponsor for you. Remember, you're in a red boat. But if you don't want to be in the red boat, I will row you up alongside another boat, right? I'll hold your hand while you're climbing in that boat. I'll blow kisses while you're being rolled, sailed, motored away, right? And hoping that you're going to give me outreach calls. Because this is not the only boat that will save you. I do know you got to get out of the water because, you know, you're chum. You are. And the sharks are circling, right? But I don't even know when you're supposed to get out of the water. And, you know, so, but if you're in my boat, here's the deal. So we're going to do stuff. And there's going to be a lot of direction. We're going to do stuff on a daily basis. And I don't care what you eat. I tell them that. And I say, and if I'm your sponsor, I'm in charge of your abstinence now. You are no longer in charge of your abstinence. I'm in charge. And so I'm holding your abstinence. So I decide that you're abstinent. So just like my sponsor did with me in 2000, that woman who changed my life, May 30th, 2000, she said, I'm declaring that you're abstinent. I'm holding your abstinence. You get on with working the steps and get on with being in your life, right? I'm in charge of your abstinence. You're not. So now let's figure out what you're going to be doing on a daily basis. So if they're willing to do that, and I say, so I don't care what you eat. I just would hope for you that you're not going to lie to me about it. And it's tricky with chronic slippers, right, because we're liars, right? So most of the time they're going to lie to you, which is a drag. I don't like to be lied to. I don't. It's a drag. But it just happens. It happens more often than you would imagine, right? But I just tell people, because you can only tell people this. The only way you can tell something works on faith is if somebody is willing to step out into it and walk in faith, right? So I will tell people from the beginning, this is a safe place for you to be honest about your food. I'm just telling you that. It's a very safe place for you to be honest. If you want to commit your food ahead of time, that's what I do. I commit my food ahead of time to my sponsor at night. If I deviate from what I do, I will write it in that email the following night. I'll say, oh, by the way, I didn't have, you know, chicken salad for lunch. I had, you know, 4 ounces of tuna or whatever, right? I just do that. That works for me. If you don't want to commit your food ahead of time and you want to just write at the end of the day what you had, that's fine too. Bless you. Whatever you want to do. But you gotta be honest about your food. You gotta be honest if you want real recovery. And notice I didn't say weight loss. And I didn't say being a size whatever. If you really want the transformation that's possible here, you're going to have to stop lying. Right? So I don't care what you eat, but I do care about the work. Because you got to give me something. Right? If we're going to work together, if I'm going to sponsor you, you got to throw me a bone. Right? Yeah. Throw me a bone with something on it. But you got to throw me a bone. You got to give me something. So you got to give me, either got to give me abstinence and the work, or you got to give me the work. But giving me abstinence is not enough. I'm very uninterested in what somebody eats. So if somebody calls me and they've followed their food plan that day, but they haven't done their work, they haven't done their chapter reading or any of the other myriad things I have them do, if they haven't done that, if you do that probably 2 or 3 days, I'm going to lovingly let you go because you're not done. You're not done. And you know what? You're not going to be eating that way for long. If you're here and you believe what we believe here, right, which is that it's a spiritual problem, and I got to address that greater issue. I've got to create that transformation within before it's going to show up on my body, right? The transformation that happened to my body is the least interesting transformation that happened in my life. The least interesting. It is. Right? It's what we get attracted to, but it's the least interesting transformation that happened in my life. It just is. So I showed up at my 30-year high school reunion last summer, and I was the fat girl in high school, remember? And there are some boys who make nasty comments and stuff and all that crappy stuff that happens to men and women when you're overweight, but particularly women in high school. And, I showed up at the reunion, and, I'm not the fat girl anymore, and I look pretty good. And I tracked some of the people, right, your friends on Facebook and stuff, and you see some of those, the football captain, and they're fat now and stuff, all the Facebook stuff, and it's like, who cares? And I just couldn't wait, because I couldn't wait, and it wasn't the, talk to the hand, right, it was none of that nonsense. It wasn't all the reasons that I skipped reunions for years before. I couldn't go because I was still fat. Now I'm thin, bring it on, right? It wasn't that. I went there, and I was the absolute epitome of love. And holding him and, hugging the guy who made the crappy comment that I still remember, because I've got the problem and I'm not forgiving and I haven't adequately covered that, and we'll talk about that when we get to 8th and 9th step, right, because I haven't done my work. But to hug him and ask to see pictures of his kids and stuff like that, that's a miracle, right? That's a miracle. That's what I came for. That's what I came for. That's that real transformation. That's what I'm going for. Right? So again, we have this large conversation. So again, you got to be honest with your food, and there's going to be stuff that you're going to be doing on a daily basis. And I'm just telling you, we're going to work all those tools on it. We're going to be working the steps, right? And we'll get that there when we talk about the steps as they're outlined in the book, so specifically. But you're going to be doing step work. That's a given, right? But you're also going to be doing the tools as a chronic sleeper. And I tell all my sponsees right from the beginning, if you and I are working together, you do a meeting a day. Because you're at that point. Right? You might not know it, but you're at that point. It's gotten that bad. It has. I mean, if you've been here 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you're there. You're just there. And you'd be amazed how people will call and be like, oh, I'm so desperate. Oh, I gotta have you as a sponsor. And, meeting a day. It's like, well, I can't do a meeting a day. I work 3 jobs. Right? Or I have 19 dogs. I did. I mean, there was literally a woman. She didn't have 19, but it was like double digit. It's like, really? Really? Okay. Do you understand? Not making the connection, why this isn't working, why your life isn't working. Who's not at the top of your list? I mean, literally, I think she had 11 dogs. If you have 11 dogs, I mean, is that even legal? Is that even legal? But if you have 11 dogs, maybe she lives in Malibu, I don't know. But if you have 11 dogs, really? I mean, I have 2 dogs and I just feel flummoxed, right? How can you, really? Is that working at all for anybody? Is it working for the dogs? I mean, is it working for anybody? We don't make the connection between why this isn't working and why I haven't made myself a priority. So that's kind of the gist of the conversation. But I say, you're going to be working, and it's not even the 9 tools. I mean, I don't count the action plan. I don't even know what that means, really. But maybe Jessica can explain that to me. I don't know what that means. But I take the 8 tools, and then we add prayer and meditation, because quite frankly, prayer and meditation, I think, should be tools. Right? And we're going to work all 10 of those on a daily basis. You're going to send me an email at the end of the night confirming that you've worked all those tools, including 3 live outreach calls. And the only way it counts if you don't make live outreach calls is if you do double the number of calls where you reach out to people. So see, I keep giving people all these reasons, and there's a part of me in the back of my head like, maybe this will make them say, no, I don't want to do this with you. Right? You just keep kind of throwing it out, right? But no, usually most people, by the time they end up on the phone with me, they kind of get it, how it's going to go. So, people listen to the works, there's workshops and, phone stuff out there and stuff. So people kind of know this is how it works. And again, these are not my good ideas. So the book is very specific. There are 92 musts in the big book, right? In the first 164 pages. The first one's on Roman numeral 16, and it says, we must do these things if we want to recover. Right? So it's very specific. I always tell sponsors, I say, you can call them suggestions if you want, but it's actually not suggestion. They're directions. And, if you don't want to call them direction, okay, but it's kind of like, if you fall in a pool and you don't know how to swim, I suggest you start moving your arms and your legs. Right? I mean, let's just try it. So I just say to people, because I don't want to lie to you. I'm not going to give you suggestions. I'm going to give you direction. I'm going to give you direction to take on a daily basis. And if you don't do it, after about 2 or 3 or 4 days, if you don't do it, I'm going to lovingly let you go because you're not done. And it's okay to not be done. I love you. Right? I don't care what you eat. We can still go on lunch dates together. You eat what you want. I know what I'm going to eat. I am not threatened by somebody eating macaroni and cheese and a piece of apple pie in front of me. It is not a threat to my abstinence, not at all. So, you know, and I love you. I don't care what you eat, you know. But if we're going to work together, we're going to do the deal, and we're going to do work, and there's work on a daily basis. And it, those same 10 tools that I ask them to send to me at night, I send those to my sponsor. And my sponsor didn't ask for that. I asked a woman to sponsor me in OA, and I said, would it be okay if I sent you, you know, these tools on a daily basis that I'm working on? She said, okay. Right? And she's since told me that this is really helping her program, right? Because she's now paying attention to it. So it's a commitment of your food, right? It's a commitment that you've done service. And remember, sitting in meetings and being quiet is a service. It's sponsorship, so it's some connection with me. And we'll talk, again, very specifically how I do it in terms of the contact. But it's meeting a day, because that's what you're doing for the 2 or 3 months that you and I are working together, and we go through the big book, right, and go through the steps. It's practicing anonymity, keep your mouth shut, not just about to outside people, you know, because people have, I think, are misinformed about this in terms of, well, I can't tell Joe Smith, who's not in program, that, you know, Mary Beth is. I don't go to Tom in program and say, oh, my friend Mary, you know, have you met my friend Mary? She's in program. I don't do that. I keep my mouth shut. I don't tell anybody about anybody. A lot of times I set people up on blind dates, and usually they're people from 12-step programs, and I'll always say to Mary, okay, Mary, now if I end up introducing you to somebody who's in program, do you want me to tell them that you're in program? Do you want me to tell them you're in OA? Yeah, sure, okay. And I say to Tom, now if I set you up with somebody, do you want, you know, the person to know that you're in AA? Yeah, sure, that's fine. Well, then I let them know. Otherwise, I don't. And people say, well, it doesn't count because it's, you know, I can tell Mary that, you know, Beth is in program. Really? Where do you get that? So again, just kind of paying attention, you know, and it's where we're looking at all this foundational stuff. Like, how do we have so many books out there, but we don't have as many people staying sober? Like, where is that coming from? Where is the breakdown? You know, they were pretty clear in the beginning. And I want to kind of, you know, I pay attention to that stuff. So, all right, so it's a meeting, anonymity, literature, and writing. You're going to be writing on a daily basis. You're going to be writing. You're going to be reading some literature. You're going to be doing those telephone calls, and you're going to be praying. I give them the three prayers, the same prayers that sponsor gave me in 2000. Those are the same prayers I do in the morning, and then I've added some of my own. And it's like the third step prayer, serenity prayer. It's the first three steps, and then I do the on awakening. And on awakening, age 86 or 88, the big book, step 11. And then you're going to sit quiet, you know, you're going to meditate on a daily basis. And we're getting started right away on that, right? And people say, well, I don't know how to meditate. I say, sit in a chair and shut up. Just start there. Just start there. Great start, right? And that's what we're going to be doing on a daily basis. And if you don't want to do those things, it's really okay. And that this is not the only way to recover. But this is the way to recover if you're in my boat. And if you don't want to be in my boat, let me help you find another boat. I would just wish for you that you get in a boat. That's all. So then we get going, right? And, you know, they've gotten it with the line. So that's, we've got all those bases covered. If they want to do a food plan, if they want to go see my registered dietitian, my dietitian will take people on referral, but only on referral. She'll take on my referral. If they can't afford it, I say, let's look at your food. Let's look at the Dignity of Choice food plan. We have this wonderful pamphlet in OA. Let's work together. I do 3 meals and 2 snacks as a general rule. You know, my dietitian, I just saw her yesterday. We're kind of trying something different, experimenting with kind of, you know, getting rid of some snacks for a while because I have some other health things that are, another doctor is saying, please stop doing, you know, eating late at night. So, you know, but I do this all under the aegis of somebody who's got more information than me. I'm not in charge of my food today. I'm not in charge. I do 2 things right with my food today. I'm not in charge of it, and I'm honest about it. I have a sponsor that I can be completely, completely honest with about my food. That's essential. That's essential for me. And that's how we do it. So that's the communication with chronic slippers, right? So it's not, and again, nobody who's doing it differently is doing it wrong. I know people who have sponsored people who are chronic slippers here, taking their calls day after day after day after day for years, right? And that loving thing, that's a wonderful thing. And if that works for you and that works for the person, that is terrific. See, that did not work from my experience. I had really loving sponsors who would do that. What I didn't have, unfortunately, and I take responsibility for this because, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. And so I did not seek them out. But I didn't have anybody who was very clearly giving me direction, loving direction. Again, I don't need anybody to shame me. That doesn't work. But I do need somebody to be honest with me and tell me the truth. I do need that. I need somebody to tell me the truth. So I will tell sponsees, especially chronic slippers, right in that first conversation the truth. You're a liar, and you're a victim. And you're creating that. And if you want to do something different, let's do something different. And I can help you if you take my direction. But it's if you call me and you haven't done the things that I've asked you to do, I'm not sure that I'm the sponsor for you. Because then because what's going to start happening, right? If I say, okay, well, yeah, maybe you don't need to do a meeting a day. You know, maybe you don't need to do this. Maybe you don't need to work all the tools. Maybe you don't need to make those outreach calls. Who wants to make outreach calls, right? Maybe you don't, you know what I'm going to start thinking? I don't need to do that stuff. I don't need to do that stuff. And you know what? I need to do that stuff. I really need to do that stuff. Because I've been at goal weight for a few years now. That didn't solve my problem. I'm glad my legs don't chafe anymore in the middle. I'm glad, right? But that didn't solve my problem. Being overweight was not my problem. It would be great if being fat had been my problem. Because then everybody who gets to goal weight would be done with their problems. That wasn't my problem. I have the same problems now that I had when I came in, to a much lesser extent. I don't know how to love. I don't love readily. And I don't forgive readily. Those are my problems. I don't love myself readily, easily. And I don't forgive myself readily and easily. And if I'm not doing it at home, I ain't doing it for you. Right? Those are my problems. Right? And then there's the whole, the second level, right? All the character defects and all that ancillary stuff. But at its core, it's about love and forgiveness. So let's start dealing with those issues. Right? So that's what we do in terms of chronic slipping. So it's a lot of clarity, and it's a lot of direction, because I need to figure out very quickly whether somebody's done. And I'm not going to know that unless I see whether they're doing the work, not whether they're staying abstinent. No, the abstinence will come. That's out of my hands, right? Remember, dead mom, dead brother. That's out of my hands. I have no control over that. I can't get anybody abstinent. But I can support you in doing what you say you want to do, or I can support you in saying I'm not going to lie anymore and say that I want to be abstinent, but I don't want to work. Right? Not when you've got somebody standing in front of you who said, I did what you've done for years, and it didn't work for me. Maybe you want to try something different. So let's try something different. So that's how it goes in terms of sponsoring chronic slippers, in terms of the actual practical work. And my sponsees call me 5 days a week at a set time, and then on weekends it's a floating call. So I like their call to come in on weekends before noon. So and their call time is a set time, because clarity is good. Clarity is good for everybody. And this woman who sponsored me, remember the game changer? She had 4 people that she sponsored. She was a very powerful woman. She had a very powerful, still does, very powerful job in the film business. And she sponsored 4 of us. And she talked to women from 7:30 to 8:30 in the morning. So your call time was at 8 to 8:15. That was my call time. And I remember she said to me, and then this is what I now say to my sponsees, right? If your call time is at 8 o'clock and you call me at 8 o'clock, we're going to talk for 15 minutes. If you call me at 5 after, we're going to talk for 10. If you call me at 10 after, we're going to talk for 5. If you keep it up, I'm probably going to let you go because you don't want what I have. And that's all right. You know what? I don't want what I have sometimes. It's okay, right? It's okay, right? So it's not like some punitive thing, like, you don't want what I have, so I'm letting you go. It's like, it's okay. Maybe the red boat's not the boat for you, right? I don't have all the, and that is really liberating, wonderful news for people who've been chronically slipping for a long time. I had a next-door neighbor, a woman who was, she was an 85-year-old woman. She was dying of emphysema, and she still smoked, right? Of course, she'd smoked for 65 years. And I remember I was at her house one day, and something, and she went to light up a cigarette. She said, I got to put this out, don't I? And I said, I don't know, do you? She said, well, you're probably going to tell me, that I can't smoke. And I said, well, why would I tell you that? It's not my business. It's not my business if you smoke. And she started crying. And she said, nobody's ever told me that. She said, I was married to a man for 55 years who told me to, you know, I should quit smoking. And then when I got the emphysema, my family, that's all they ever say. I have to hide my cigarettes. She said, nobody ever said that to me. I said, you're a grown woman. It's not my business what you do. Right? It's a very powerful thing when you say to somebody who feels, I have not been invited to the party, I can't do this. If you say, well, here are some things for you to do, and these are things that worked for me. And if you want me to help you, I will help you. But I got to have you taking direction, right? Because we already know that your good ideas aren't working, right? Just be out of good ideas. Be out of good ideas. You know why? You don't have any, right? Be out of good ideas. You don't have any good ideas. And you know what? I don't have any good ideas. But there's a source. There's one source. Got great ideas. And that's the third step, and we'll talk about that. So I think the original plan was actually that we were going to do a Q&A at the end, but let's open up. Let's do 10 minutes of Q&A, and then we're going to take a potty break at 10:30. And if I just may reserve one of those bathrooms at 10:30, I'm going to race in quickly. So, right? Yes, please, my love.
Sheila, I have two questions.
Yes. And then I'm going to repeat the question so we get it on the tape, which I guess we should do.
You talked about working the steps with Big Book.
Yep. We'll go through that after break.
What about working the steps through the OA?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
As long as you just do
it. Well, no, not with me. If you work with me, we're going to go through the steps in the Big Book. And what I'm going to do is it's only going to take us a couple of months. And then I lovingly let you go. And I say, go find another sponsor. Right? Because you know what I'm going to say at that point. You know how this is going to go. Right? By the time we've gone through the steps and you've talked to me, as consistently as you've talked to me, you know how it's going to go with me. Go find and do what somebody else says. I'm going through the steps right now, Jessica, in the OA workbook again.
That's Jessica.
I mean Ellie. Yes, I'm doing that. Yeah, of course, Jessica and Ellie, my two stalwart people on the board. I'm going through the workbook right now. I adore that workbook. It's wonderful, and I did it like 11 years ago. That's what I did with the 2000 sponsor. It was wonderful. So it's a game changer. So yes, there are lots of wonderful ways to do this. If you're doing it with me, we're going through the steps in the Big Book. That's all I do with people. I only sponsor from the Big Book, exclusively.
Okay, and the other question was, when you talk about somebody not needing to be abstinent, when I read the doctor's opinion, more often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he's approached?
Yeah, more often than not.
Okay.
Right. And I just don't subscribe to the idea that alcoholism is the same thing as an eating disorder. I just don't. And I'm not going to, I don't, like, people always want to have that debate. I'm not going to have that debate. It just didn't work for me. Now, Ellie, would this work with somebody who's drinking? I don't know. I've never had an alcoholic who was who kept drinking while we were kind of going together. Alcoholics will cut and run. I've actually never had it. I've had one, and he's in this room, my lovely, lovely friend who's in this room. I don't know if he wants me to out him either. But I've had one. Well, I've had two, but I think I sponsored him differently. So I've had one alcoholic who we've gone through the steps the way we have. Otherwise, they usually cut and run. But there's something different, when it's either the ego, like, I cannot be fat anymore, right? I can't take this. It's either that, or it's just that we're heartier people or something. But alcoholics will usually cut and run. So I've never had anybody who kind of was in and out of the drink and then doing this. So maybe that wouldn't work. But Ellie, I just don't think the same is true with food. I just don't. There's too many layers. It's too much stuff involved. The pathology is too nascent. There's something else. It's different. And again, he's more often than not. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. You made it very clear that you certainly are willing to let sponsorees go if they're not ready to take your direction.
But if they're not willing to do the work.
Willing to do the work, thank you. But what I heard you say is you'll row them up to another boat. It sounds like you won't throw someone back in the water.
So no.
You continue to be their temporary sponsor until they find someone.
Oh, we'll find.
How do you do that? Or you find a sponsor for them?
I will do that. I always kind of have, sponsees and stuff. No, I will absolutely do that. And again, this is a conversation. I've never had to say to somebody. There was one time, I don't fire people and let people go like that unless you want to be abusive, right? I'm not here for you to work out your mother issues. I'm not. And I'm not a therapist. And there was somebody who wanted to be really abusive, and I remember she called me back an hour later, and she was like, well, I know you don't let people go unless they, you know, don't do the work. So I did the work, but, you know, so here I am, bitch, calling you again. It's like, no. Right? I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not going to do that. But otherwise, what's your name?
Rob,
this ends up being a conversation. You know what I mean? It's just where we, you know, I'll tell, you know, like, Monica, honey, maybe this isn't working for you. And I understand. I understand if you don't want to do a meeting a day. I really do. And it's okay. And I'm not sitting back here thinking, okay, it's just a matter of time. Okay, you don't want to do the work. It's not that. It's, you know, it's not for everybody. It's not the only way to do this. There are a lot of ways to do this. I'm being wonderfully sponsored by a woman in Overeaters Anonymous who has not taken me through the big book. Right? So there's lots of wonderful ways to do this. Let's just find something that works for you. The thing that I have going on, I do have a lot of experience with this. That's why I'm doing the workshop, right? It's not the only way. It's a way. It's just a way that's worked. So we just want to find something. There are a lot of people who feel they can't get abstinent. And I'm telling you, it has to do with the work. And when you really look at the deep work that this book asks us to do, this stuff transforms. You see why they can reference 6 times, right, that people have recovered from alcoholism. I'm also not going to debate with people whether I'm going to be calling myself recovered or recovering, right? I refuse to participate in those debates. But they called themselves recovered for a reason. Because if you really do this deep work, you get transformed. And you'd have to work really, really hard to get back into the food or get back into the behavior and not be able to be accountable to it. It doesn't mean you might not get goofy with the behavior. You might tell a lie here or something. But you're not going to be able to sit on it long. And you're going to come back to your sponsor and you're going to say, you know what, I lied again. Or, I didn't tell you, I actually ate a 16-ounce ribeye and not a 4-ounce portion, right? Remember, I just said that to my sponsor like 2 weeks ago after our meeting. I said, you mean I can't eat a 16-ounce ribeye anymore? And she said, no. And I said, oh, that's so sad. She said, no, that's sad that you think it's that sad. But no, there are actually sadder things than the fact that you don't get to gorge on a ribeye, baby. But anyway, so it's a conversation. You know what I mean? And we figure out together, you know? Yeah. Yep.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you.
Hi, Lisa.
Why end the relationship after a couple of months or after going through the steps?
Yeah.
Why end the relationship?
Because there are so many people. I get 50 calls a week. You know, I've done stuff in other programs, and there's workshops and stuff I've done out there. I get a lot of calls from people. There are a lot of people, and I only have a certain amount of time. And again, that's why I'm putting the workshop out there. And I'm not saying I'm like this wonderful thing. I don't know if I would be sponsored by me. I really don't. I'm surprised my husband married me, quite frankly. But there's just a lot of people. There's a lot of people. And it's not for me anyway. Anything you're responding to in me, you're responding to the God within me, right? And this book is really powerful. So what I've shown you as we've gone through the steps is you've had that experience of transformation. And the transformation is basically about, I'm going to forgive everybody on that 4-step, right? And we'll talk about that when we get there. And I was molested, right? And I forgive the molesters. And just about every woman who ends up being sponsored by me, you know, however this works out, is an incest survivor, right? And when you do that really deep work, and we'll talk about that, because it says you've made your 8-step list when you took your 4-step. So I know then that everybody who ended up on my 4-step list ends up on my 8-step list, right? So when you do that really deep stuff, you've had a transformation. And when we get you in that regular routine of you're doing a 10-step like it talks about on page 84, you got those 4 steps of the 10th step you take throughout the day, not the 10th step it talks about in the 12 and 12. But when you're doing that stuff and you're praying and meditating on a daily basis and you are living the Working with Others chapter, you're getting it that it's not just about 12-step work. Your life is all about service. When you start living that way, I have nothing else to offer you. And I want to offer that message to as many people as possible. That's all. That's why. Right? And then we still talk. I mean, you know, we're buddies. You know, one of my sponsees is here. You know, we're buddies. You know, we love each other. And, you know, you call me your sponsor. I don't care what you call me. It's just, you know, your time slot's not yours anymore. But, you know, whatever. But that's just it. That's it. And let me bestow the prize of Sheila on more people. It's not that. It's let me carry the message. You know, on my bad days, I feel really bad that I fooled around in program for 12 years. I went through my 30s. I don't have any children because my childbearing years, I was in sugar, right? So I do this, Elizabeth, so that on my bad days, I don't feel like, well, I'm a failure, right? I'm 48, I'm overeducated and underemployed, and I'm about to, you know, apply for a doctoral program. It's like, really? Is that the solution? You sure? More education for the over? Really? Okay. I mean, I don't know. But I stayed in the sugar for a long time because I wasn't done, right? Because I wasn't done. So I do this to carry this message because it sustains me, right? I don't sponsor people to get them abstinent. I sponsor them to keep me abstinent, right? That's why I've had 100% success rate with all my sponsees. Why? Because I'm still sober and I'm still abstinent, right? So that's the deal. That's why. Yep.
Thank you so much for your insight. I was a little late, and you may have answered this already, but are you saying abstinence means no sugar?
No. No, absence is defined. You know, that's the wonderful thing we have at the, and we can have. You know, you've got longtime stalwart board members here with longtime absence. They can chat with you maybe on the break. But there's that wonderful kitchen sink meeting, right? Our 9 a.m. meeting, right? Which Nathan went to this morning before he came here on time and did the chairs and stuff. Amazing. But they have somebody stand up who describes what their abstinence is. As a matter of fact, Nathan, where are you? Right there. Stand up. What is your abstinence? This is what they do at the kitchen sink. Somebody will get up and describe their abstinence.
Over here, no white flour, no deep fried foods, no refined, no dessert sugar. I call on my food, so I give me my food every day.
Okay, so that's his abstinence, right? So he's got all those things. For me, my abstinence is no sugars, no sweets, right? No fake sugars, right? None of that stuff. I'm no flour, and for me, no dairy. It just doesn't work for me. It's an issue for me. But and then there are assorted other things I can't have in connection with a food plan and stuff. But it means different things to different people. There are some people that eat sugar in moderation. I have a girlfriend in the Midwest who her absence is no coffee Häagen-Dazs. Apparently she can eat vanilla Häagen-Dazs, and she can. I've seen her do it, right? So that's her absence. Some people, their absence is no eating in my car, no fast food, whatever it is. It's different things. Talk to everybody. You're going to get 19,000 different answers, right? But for me, sugar was my deal. Huge deal. Yep.
Thank you. What my question is you mentioned Alcoholic Anonymous, Al-Anon, and OA.
Mm-hmm.
How do you be able to work Al-Anon and OA at the same time?
Yeah. Well, I have an Al-Anon sponsor, and we're working the steps. I'm actually on my eighth step in Al-Anon. And, it's just, with my Al-Anon sponsor, that's the great thing about an Al-Anon sponsor. They're never going to bug you and tell you to do anything, as a general rule, right? Which is just so great. That's great, right? People are afraid to get an Al-Anon sponsor. I say, why? They're not going to ask you to do anything, right? They don't want to control. But they don't. So I'm on my eighth step with my Al-Anon sponsor, and actually, my AA sponsor actually moved out of state, a while ago. So I actually need to get another AA sponsor. But again, it would be more of a relaxed thing. But my eating disorder is the one that I kind of need to keep my eye on the prize. So for my OA sponsor, she has us. We talk three times a week, and then I can and then I email her every night and stuff. So that's how I do it. It's very easy. But I know people who've been very committed, who actually, worked in a concerted way with three different sponsors, like doing three different things and calls every day and all that stuff. And, this is where life, it's our life we're talking about. Bless you. It's our life we're talking about. So it just depends how bad it's gotten for you and how, if you've gotten to the point that, how we need to go. Mary, we're going to I'll take two more questions after Mary. We're
going to
break. Oh, sure. No, phone meetings are good. I always say, especially in OA, though, with the food thing, it's really important to get to, for me, it's really important for me to get to live meetings. Because I need to, especially if I've been in the food or I've been, struggling with the food, I need to let my body be seen.
Mm-hmm.
I need to let my body be seen. Because that's part of the shame. That's that old stuff that just doesn't serve me for me to be hiding out and, doing phone meetings. So yeah, no, people, phone meetings can absolutely work. There's a wonderful OA phone meetings. There's, you know, another thing. I don't know if it's an outside issue, so I'm not going to talk. Talk to me on the break. But there's, you know, there's lots of other things. Well, it's not an outside issue. There's the parking lot, which happens overnight. You know, there are OA online meetings, right? There are other 12-step food programs. I say to people, you know, and I don't care what food fellowship you go to. I just think OA is the mother. It's the mother, because it's the most loving place. And in the end, what brought me back here is I need to be in a place where I'm listening to people who are struggling. I do. I need to be able to hear people. And then I'll tell you, there are times I just feel like, really? I can't sit in another meeting listening to somebody debate whether frozen yogurt counts as a dinner. I mean, both are true. Sometimes I need real adherence to the deal, right? Like, you know, no, come on. And then other times I just need to hear somebody crying, and there are wrappers of food in my car, right? I just, you know, I need to listen to people talking with crumbs falling out of their mouth. I mean, sometimes I need that too. So, no, phone meetings and stuff definitely end up counting, Mary. But I say get to 3 live meetings. Give yourself that gift. Give us the gift. Let us make it clear to you that your value has nothing to do with what you weigh. That has nothing to do with your value. Let us help you be supported in getting that. So that's why, you know. Yep. Yes?
For people that are in other 12-step programs and have a whole other set of meetings to build a program, and you require like 2 meetings every single day,
yeah, absolutely. But again, what I would say, again, and this is for me, and this there's a little bit more leeway. I say, you know, well, you know, I'm sorry.
Repeat the question.
Oh, sure. Thank you. She's saying, you know, what's the deal if you're in other fellowships and, you know, do those meetings count? So again, and then again, this is just, I just want to make sure, you know, this is not Sheila's book of rules, right? These are just some things I've found as we go along. So yes, of course those count. But since you've got an eating disorder, and that's what seems to be giving you more trouble because you're, you know, signing up with somebody who's saying go to a meeting a day, then I would say make more of your meetings food meetings than not. So let's make 4 of those meetings during the week food meetings. Can we agree on that, right? And are you willing to go to 3 live meetings, both to support the fellowship emotionally, spiritually, and financially, right, by showing up at live meetings and contributing if you can, if you are able. And then, you know, and let's just, and then, yeah, count your AA and your Al-Anon. That's what I do. And I go to like 5 or 6 meetings a week, you know, and I've been sober 24 years. So, you know, so I try to, you know, for the most part, I'm doing what I'm asking my sponsees to do. So they don't really have a lot of room to say, hey, you're making me do too much. You know? Yep. Okay, so let's do 1 more question. Yep, or 2 more. I'll take you 2.
Thanks a lot. I was just wondering, you said at different points, one, that you don't necessarily care whether your sponsees are eating or not eating. You really more care about the work. But you also said you hold their abstinence and
yes,
they don't get to decide
yes,
whether they're... So can you talk about that, sort of the paradox a little bit, and how you sort of decide or communicate with them
well,
with their abstinence?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to tell you the secret. I don't know if I'm saying that the emperor's not wearing any clothes. I don't care what somebody eats. We are declaring you abstinent. That's the deal. And my hope for you is that you're not lying to me about it. Because let's say that your first declaration of abstinence, right, is that I'm not going to lie anymore and I'm going to start telling somebody the truth about what I'm eating. Not, I'm not eating A, B, C, D, and E, but I'm going to stop lying and I'm going to tell somebody the truth. I think that sounds like a very fine definition of abstinence. I'd be proud to stand weighing 300 pounds at the kitchen sink meeting and saying, my definition of abstinence is that I don't lie anymore and I tell my sponsor the truth about everything that goes in my mouth. And I write it down in a notebook in real time. That's the other thing I do with people, is with chronic slippers, as I say, bless you, get a little notebook and start writing down in real time what you're eating. Right? What time and what quantities, right? You can't write, I had a cheeseburger and a bag of Doritos, because I don't know if that's the Doritos you get at 7-Eleven or the one you get at Costco. Right? So you gotta throw me a bone, right? You gotta write the amount, right? The 3 3/8 ounce bag of Doritos from 7-Eleven, right? Guess who's eaten those before, right? Knows the amount. But, so that's the deal. So it's not, so we don't ever end up really in a problem with the food. The deal is, I'm not going to start anybody over. You know why? Because for you to walk around and not be abstinent, you don't have to grow up. You don't have to grow up. And quite frankly, and this is a conversation I have with most people because most people are older when they call me, right? 40, I'm 48. They're my age or older. And I say, you know what? You're supposed to be a wise elder. It is time for you to be a wise elder in the world. And you are continuing to fool around with food? How's that working for you? How's that working for your husband? How's that working for your children? Right? And all I'm saying is let's stop lying about it. Stop lying and saying that food is not food. If you're in the food is the most important thing in the world to you. And as long as you can live with that, that's fine. But let's stop lying about it. But don't kid yourself. If you've got a husband, a car, a kid, a grandkid, and you're not abstinent and you're in the food is the most important thing in the world to you. And just stop lying about it. Just say, it's at the top of my list. It's at the top of my list. Just stop lying. So you see, it's all about, like, let's just start saying stuff out loud. So that's how the abstinence goes, right? And then if you're honest, then we work it out together. If you, you know, if you come to me a month in and you say, wow, it's not working for me to do, you know, 1 pound bags of M&Ms on a daily basis. I just think praise God they finally got that. But then it's like, okay, well let's switch to the half pound. I mean let's find a way for you to be right in the middle of the winning circle so that you can be in life and start putting some time together and start contributing to the fellowship. Right? 5% of, what do they say this in all of the 12-step fellowship, it's probably true in all volunteer work. 5% of the people do 90% of the work. I know that's true in Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to the H&I meetings. So it's like, let's start contributing. And if you're not abstinent, you don't have, quite frankly, you don't have to have any positions of real responsibility in the fellowship. You really don't. You certainly don't have to be a secretary of a meeting. You know, you're not going to be a treasurer. Nobody's going to put a treasurer's kitty in your hands, right? And there are wonderful people here who do wonderful things in the program and in the fellowship. Don't get lost in what I'm saying here. I know that. But the deal is, if you are not abstinent and you're not standing in something, it takes its toll on you spiritually. Let's stop pinning yourself to that. Let's stop taking that toll. And I don't think it's fair to say to somebody who's not ready to put down the sugar, you don't get to be abstinent. You don't get to call yourself abstinent. I don't think that's fair. And it didn't work from my experience. And I did all right here. Right? And that was what somebody said to me. And all I can do is come from my experience. So that's how it works with the food. You with me? All right, and then you had one last question, then we're going to take a break. 10-minute break.
Maybe more to confirm what you're saying, because it's kind of hard for me to believe because it's so different than what I've heard the program. The thing, a slipper, I hear oftentimes...
Okay, hang on, guys. It's really hard to hear when there's chatter in the back. I know. And feel free to head outside if, you know.
A slipper, I hear in program a lot from my sponsor and other people, you're not ready. And you're saying that today, too, that you recognize some people aren't ready. My question is, I want to confirm with you, when you say you're not ready, do you mean... You know, I've always thought I'm not ready to give up the food, therefore I can't have what you just said. I can't have abstinence because I'm not ready to give up the food. But when you're saying you're not ready, you're meaning you're not ready to do the work.
Right.
Right.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, she said something. She's talking about readiness and what does that mean in terms of, you know, being done and food and this and that. And again, don't get caught up in the semantics here. You know, wait and see if you still have these same questions when we get to the big book thing. Here's my thing, and there's a difference between saying somebody's not ready versus somebody's not done. Right, and what I'm saying, and again, I hope I don't get kicked out by the elders of the program, right? But when I'm saying this, I'm just saying that I don't say to somebody, you can't declare yourself abstinent if you're not done with the food. I think you can. I was not done with sugar, and my sponsor said, I am declaring you abstinent, and we're going from here. And here's what I need you to do on a daily basis. And that woman sponsored me for 2 years, right? Because remember, it took me 7 years to do a 4-year degree, so it took me 2 years to get through that OA workbook, I'm embarrassed to say. But it did. But and that woman changed my life. I mean, I literally stopped grinding my teeth at night. So that worked for me. So if somebody's not done with the food, if you are doing the work, you're going to get done sooner rather than later. It has been a slow decline in my weight number since I came in program and started working the steps. Now, thin isn't well, but neither is fat, right? So if the deal is that we can agree on that, so that then we're all at the starting point, right? That means we can't walk in a meeting and decide how much value somebody has or how much we should listen to somebody based on what they weigh. Since we already know that doesn't apply, because thin and fat alike are not well, right? Since we know that now, then it just means let me deal with the real stuff, which will become very, very clear as I work the steps as they're outlined in the book. Let me deal with the real stuff. Let me get transformed within, and it can't help but showing up on your body, right? As within, so without. So let's transform. So that's what it is. So that's what I mean. If somebody's not done with the food, but you are willing to do the work, I can help you. But if you're not done and you're not willing to do the work, I'm not the person for you. Maybe you need to talk to somebody, you know, be sponsored by somebody who will just take your call every morning and love you, and that's great, you know. Cleave to their bosom. That's terrific. And that can be a wonderful, holy thing. It's a wonderful thing. I don't know what everybody else needs to do. I know what has worked for me and what seems to have been of service to people that I've sponsored. That's all. That's all we're talking about today. It's just a conversation, really. Right, except you don't get to talk. I'm doing all the talking. All right, very good. So let's take a break, and I'm going to run through it.